This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 238. Today we speak with Dr. Barry Waugh about Machen's time on the front in World War I. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 238. My name is Camden Busey. We have another fun program lined up for you today. Let me introduce to you our panel. We have Jeffrey Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jeff.
Oh, it's good to be here, Camden.
And you're going to have an augmented title here soon, aren't you?
Lord willing, beginning the first Sunday in August, I will be serving as stated supply at Knox Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania.
So, but yes. Retaining your teacher of the congregation status.
Correct.
Until they can find a pastor or call a pastor, you're going to be working there. That's great to hear. It's great to have you on, and we look forward to our discussion today. We're very excited to welcome to the program for the first time Dr. Barry Waugh. He is the editor of a fantastic new book titled Letters from the Front. He also transcribed many of these letters, which are J. Gresham Machen's correspondence from World War I. Welcome to the program, Barry. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you, Camden. It's nice that you have me on to interview me.
Oh, sure. Well, it's great. We appreciate you taking the time out of the day. We mostly appreciate you putting this book together, and we're going to dive into it today, asking questions about Machen, learning about his life and this period in his life that is so significant, the time in which he served as a YMCA secretary on the front in World War I. But before we get into discussing our book, I should mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We encourage you to visit our website today. If you can, if you're not driving, get on your computer or on your phone and visit us at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support today. We're very much in need. We have expenses, and it does cost to record these programs and to distribute them. And so as we receive support, we're able to distribute them to many people free of charge, anyone who wants them. And things have been slow in the summer months, so we encourage you to visit us online today, reformedforum.org/donate. Thank you so much for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, guys, this is great. Now, Jeff, have you been able to look through this title, and what were your thoughts when you first saw this? Letters from the Front, J. Gresham Machen's correspondence from World War I.
Oh, I was, you know, excited about it because I'm familiar with some of the letters that made it into Ned Stonehouse's biography of Machen, right?
Yeah.
So I already was interested. This is like preaching to the choir, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to get my hands on the books to see more of what he said. I am assuming that this is a lot of correspondence with his mother, but maybe there's other letters to other people as well.
There are.
Like Armstrong. Is it Armstrong?
Some family members and other people we can get into. Yeah. Now, Barry,
Arthur.
The first time I saw this title, I realized that you transcribed and edited. I've done a little bit of work with the Cornelius Van Til archives. And, you know, maybe someday, it'd be fun to try to do a project like this. But it became very quickly apparent to me that this is a tremendous effort. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of putting this book together? How do you take an actual physical paper letter, a whole bunch of them, and then get them to the point in which they can be published as a book? What does that involve?
What I did was I obtained photocopies of the originals through Grace Mullen, who is the archivist at Westminster Seminary, and then just put them in chronological order and went through and started transcribing. I found that the handwriting, compared with some of the handwritings I've worked with, is really pretty good, even in the situations where Machen was under stress and in a hurry. And you start to learn people's quirks and their habits and that sort of thing. And as time goes by and you get through more and more letters, they go faster.
Huh.
But in terms of the time I was involved in the actual transcription, I really don't know, because it was stretched over about 3 years, mm-hmm. hitting bits and pieces here and there. But I'll say, in comparison, I think one of the worst handwritings I ever have seen is B.B. Warfield. And he must have had an absolutely remarkably gifted and patient secretary to take his book manuscripts and put them into a typed form whatever. I enjoy it. I mean, it's primary source material. Uh-huh. It's material that most people would never see unless they decide to go to Westminster and read the original letters. And I'm happy with making the letters available to people.
Now, you've noticed also that there were some quirks and challenges dealing with the fact that Machen wrote with a fountain pen. In one case, you say he called one of his fountain pens, I think it was a watering can, right? I mean, what type of challenges did that pose? Just the fact that Machen was writing with, you know, wasn't typing and wasn't even writing with a ballpoint pen, but was writing with a fountain pen.
The pen he mentioned was a replacement pen. Mm-hmm. His fountain pen that he loved dearly, I believe he lost it.
Oh.
So he bought a pen there somewhere in France and mixed up apparently his own ink, and it just didn't work well. I think I mentioned in a footnote that if he would have mixed the ink powder with linseed oil instead of water, the ink would have probably worked pretty well. But at times, the letters tended to bleed together with his watering can pen, and he had a habit of going back over things to correct them instead of making his corrections between the lines.
Oh.
So then you'd have these two bleeded in words on top of each other. And so sometimes it was kind of hard to figure out what was going on.
I see. Well, you've done a tremendous job, and you know, the editing involved here. I just wanted, as we began, to let the listeners know how much work goes into something like this. I mean, we just live in an age of copy and paste, you know, on a computer, and or even optical character recognition, and that's just not possible with these letters. So, Dr. Waugh has done a tremendous service for us in bringing us these letters. Now, I should step back and just in terms of history. Can you place this time period in context for us? Can you describe for us roughly the dates of World War One? Because many of us are very vague on our historical knowledge, unfortunately. When did this start, and what time period roughly was this in Machen's life? What was he doing at the time?
Well, the war is generally considered to have begun with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand
right.
in June 28, 1914. And because of treaties between countries and alliances and all these other things, several countries were brought into the conflict. And the war had been raging for 3 years or so when the United States entered the conflict. The United States entered very slowly. It was ill-prepared to get involved in the war. There had been a spirit of pacifism and don't get involved. And so when the United States did enter, it was at a crucial time because the Germans were getting ready for their annual spring offensive. The Russian Revolution had taken place, and the Germans were able to pull troops from the Eastern Front and make them to strengthen the Western Front, and they were planning on just running the French over in France. And so Pershing and the American troops entered the battle, and along with that there came the need for support work. And again, the military was ill-prepared for that. You know, soldiers need razor blades and snacks and cigarettes and the other things that they want to have. And so the YMCA got involved in that support type of work, and that's how Machen got involved. And he was one of, I think it was 1,300 American YMCA directors, and may have been even more than that, but pretty substantial operation, raised a tremendous amount of money to help the soldiers out with writing paper and entertainment and sports and the other things that the soldiers would want to do when they were able to have downtime from the trenches.
Yeah.
How is it that Machen became involved with the YMCA over in France at the front, as opposed to, say, being a soldier or serving as a chaplain or serving as a medic in the ambulance corps?
Well, Machen did not feel that as a minister he could be involved in a combatant role. He investigated being a chaplain, decided not to go that route, and so he investigated his options with regard to other things that he could do to help in the war effort. And he decided on the YMCA. It's kind of interesting that he was introduced to the YMCA by J. Ross Stevenson, who happened to be one of the leaders of the YMCA. And he mentions early on that he wasn't really happy with that. It was not an ideal situation, but that he thought it was a compromise he could make to help the soldiers and contribute to the war effort and bring the war to an end.
What was he doing at the time that he joined the YMCA?
He was assistant professor of New Testament literature and exegesis at Princeton Seminary.
Okay. Now, I know the answer to this question, but folk in the listening audience may not. But did Machen have any strong convictions about the war? Knowing, you know, and you may want to fill in the details, but initially, Woodrow Wilson, who had been president of Princeton University and then became governor of New Jersey and then president of the United States, didn't he run on a stay out of the war ticket?
Yes.
Or is my memory?
Yes.
Okay, so what is Mason's? Yes. Go ahead.
I was just going to, I just said yes. He that was Wilson's policy. I mean, it's part of the reason the troops had so much trouble getting mobilized to go. They were not, you know, that was Wilson's plan, you know,
right.
Let's stay out of this.
But then the U-boats had sunk some freight liners, and the U.S., it became apparent that it just really wasn't realistic to stay out of it. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the spring of 1918, as I mentioned earlier, it was going to be a crucial time, and the U.S. entered the conflict technically in, I believe it was April of 1917. And they actually did not see any combat until the fall of 1917. They were very slow getting mobilized and getting people over there and getting set up for conflict. And so it was, America just wasn't ready to be involved, but it was necessary that America become involved. I don't know what would have happened if the American troops had not been there when the Germans made their big onslaught in the spring of 1918. Most likely, I think they would have made their way to Paris and things would have been different.
Now, how long did Machen serve in the YMCA? How long was he overseas?
He was there from January of 1918, early January, until the spring of 1919 in March.
Okay. It's a little over a year. And did he just, was it typical for, you know, professors or other people to be involved in some way? Did they just give him a, you know, leave of absence? Or how did that work with his relationship being an associate or assistant professor?
I think he took a leave of absence. It was, you know, his opportunity to go and help. And it was common. one of the things in the letters that was interesting was that here he was going over to help out with the war effort, and there's several comments in there about him not being able to pay his taxes. And apparently he was, you know, here he is overseas, and the government wouldn't even give him a break on filing his income tax return. So
things you got to worry about. That's the last thing you want to handle when you're hearing mortar fire and, you know, the IRS is getting down your back.
Remember, the income tax is introduced, I believe, because of World War One, isn't it?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
Things were different then.
I really think that the income tax was at least partially driven by coming out of the robber baron era and, you know, okay. The guys that made their massive fortunes without paying much in the way of taxes.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, what war activities or consequences of war did Machen witness? He was on the front, but what was part of his experience?
Well, he saw some combat. He saw battlefields with equipment and bodies on the battlefield. He saw observation balloons. He talks about the noise of the aircraft and machine gun fire. You know, he was behind the trenches. He was not close enough to really have the sense of the horrors of trench warfare. But he makes comments like it would be wonderful to see a whole piece of glass somewhere, you know, that all the windows around were shattered. And at one point he mentioned hearing a child, you know, and it was the first child he'd heard and he didn't know how long, and helping an elderly man at a train station, you know, who was having a lot of trouble. And you know, it was just the whole war was just this huge catastrophe, as wars generally are. We think about the glory of war, which doesn't particularly float my boat. I think of war as horror. But war is tragedy, and it's just the people that are the non-combatants, at least in terms of the field of conflict, are the ones who suffer. You know, the French people having to roll down the street with a little wagon full of what goods they could save as the Germans advance. And just the whole situation was terrible, and Machen saw some of it. He saw a man die, I think it was outside the door of one of the buildings he was in, and he helped in first aid stations. He calls them dressing stations, but we would call them first aid stations.
Sure.
And it was, it had to be a great transition to be involved in the war coming from the background that he came from. He came from a wealthy family. He was privileged. He had the best in education. He had his suits tailor-made. And here he was fighting in war with the same uniform he'd been wearing for months. He hadn't bathed in months. He found himself jumping into shell holes full of water to avoid shell fire. You know, it was it had to be a special transition for him. But he doesn't really complain about it. He comments on it. You know, I had to jump in a shell hole to get away from danger. But he doesn't complain. And part of the reason he couldn't complain, or I think motivating his lack of complaint, is the fact that guys were dying. And he was a minister, and he wanted to do what he could do to help.
Yeah.
Yeah, Barry, he went into the war not convinced that the British were necessarily completely on the side of right, nor that the Germans were completely on the side of wrong. However, I think at some point, seeing what you've just described, he came to the conclusion that the Allies had to win the war. Is any of that expressed in the letters?
Yeah, he... Well, I don't know that he specifically mentioned that the Allies had to win the war. He did talk a bit about that when the war was over, he was going to be a proponent of peace whenever he could. That having seen the horrors of the war, he was going to support efforts for peace. I think that by the time he had decided to go with the YMCA overseas, I can't think of any specific mentions of this in the letters, but by the time he decided to go, he realized, you know, this is the best thing I can do. Not only is it best in terms of his calling as a minister, but it was best in terms of the hoped for result, which was the defeat of Germany and their allies. So, you know, I think he had to accept that to be involved. But you're right, he had struggles. He had spent time studying in Germany. He had a love for the German people. He saw their side of things, maybe as other people would not have seen their side. He was an opponent of the draft. You know, he had struggles. He fought through any issue that came up. It was, and what makes him interesting is he doesn't follow the party line. He thinks for himself, and of course, I think that's part of the reason he had troubles in the Presbyterian Church, is that he thought for himself. He wasn't yeah. going to follow the party line.
Sure.
And, you know, it's like his vote against supporting the Prohibition Act, the Volstead Act,
mm-hmm.
You know, in the presbytery. People thought, well, you know, being a Christian Presbyterian meant you wanted to stop the booze flowing. And Machen saw that as an infraction or on a person's right to make their own choices. I remember reading a letter he wrote complaining about putting the traffic signal up in Philadelphia because it restricted his freedom. This is a guy that, you know, thought for himself.
Yeah, that's
he would be very uncomfortable nowadays. You know, we have our politically correct divisions, and he would find himself in the middle a lot, I think,
yeah.
in some decisions.
Now, whenever we think about Machen's correspondence, I think we necessarily have to address his close relationship with his mother. Many of the letters written to his mother, there could be reasons for that. But how would you characterize Machen's particular relationship with his mom?
Well, it's important that at this point in his life, his father had died in 1915, so his mother's a widow.
And he was much older, 20-some years older than Minnie, right?
Yes, he was an older man. And she was there with two servants, Betty and William, that I know of. Family lived in Baltimore. But his brothers, I know his older brother, Arthur Webster II, the second, was married and had children. I'm not 100% sure his younger brother had children at this point, but they had families. Machen was, of course, single all his life. And I think he kind of took up the mantle, if you will, of keeping a particular eye on his mother and as he could. And in the comment, in the early letters, before he goes to his first hut assignment at St. Maud, and there's a lot of talk about his learning French and his going to the French plays and his reading French literature and French poetry and these things and getting involved in the French culture. He complained considerably about what I would call or has been called the ugly American who goes to France or Germany or Japan or wherever and expects everybody to be like Americans, speak
right.
English. And he thought that the Americans over there should make at least a few polite efforts to learn a little bit of French so that they could converse with the nationals. And getting back to his mother, there are hints in the letters that his mother had an extensive, or at least a more extensive knowledge of French and French life than Machen did. And I think that in those early letters, when he's talking a lot about French and France, he's got a point of contact with his mom. And something that she could really get into as he told about the plays he attended and his efforts to learn French. He actually would go and eat meals with a widow, Madame Lalotte, a widow of a French pastor, and converse with her. And these were all things that his mother could identify with, and the family back home could get some sense of what he was trying to do and how he was involved with the French people. But he got really irritated with Americans because the general failure to, you know, they were there to do a job, kind of, and they're going to be American while they're there, and no effort to learn the language and to try to get along with the French people and in their own language and their own culture. So I say that because there was a brief online comment about the book that in the early part of the book you would not know that there was a war going on. I think it's true. There were some hints here and there as he talked about having to walk in the dark and that kind of thing because you couldn't have the lights on for the airplanes and that sort of thing. But I think he's connecting with his mother.
Yeah.
And complaining about Americans.
How
I remember. Go ahead.
Oh, I just curious to ask how if you've read any of his correspondence with his mother while he was in Germany, and if there are any interesting similarities or differences between the two sets of letters.
No, that's a good thought. Right. I haven't done that. I do know that the. Can't think of his name, professor down at Covenant College, wrote an article on Machen's correspondence.
Yeah, Bill Dennison?
He was in Germany. Yes, that's right. Thank you. And that was interesting read to look at that.
Now, other than his mother, were there any figures that were particularly influential on Machen at this time? Does he write about other people he worked with? Were there other family members he was writing to?
Well, I would say his friends at Princeton were Armstrong and Patton.
Yeah.
Particularly close, and they are mentioned. I believe they're both mentioned at some point in the letters. And, just by nature of the letters being written to his mother, the great, 95% of the mentions about people are family.
Yeah.
His sister-in-laws, his nephews and nieces, and his brother, and, that kind of thing. There was a sort of extended comments about J. Ross Stevenson and a little bit of a tiff they got into while Machen was in France. And that's Machen actually asked his mother to snip the sentences out of the letter in which he had made some negative comments about Stevenson, and that portion is missing from the letter. So interesting.
Wow.
He had a great sense, that his letters, not only these war letters, but his letters in general, may have some significance in the future. Some might call that a big ego. But
or maybe he was thinking for family or nephews, nieces, maybe even future children he thought he might have had. Maybe.
That too. Again, the letters, the family enjoyed the letters. They wanted to publish them. And, of course, because of the war, Machen was very strict about following the instruction he had received about how the letters were to be handled. So he discouraged that at that point in time.
Huh.
But it's the letters home and his relationship to his mother, he was, I think, supporting her. There are indications from comments that he makes in the letters that she had a frail constitution about something, not really quite clear what it was. She did go to a different area. I believe it was in the summer to get away because of her health problem. There was a mention of fumigating her room or her home because I guess of some thought that there might be some kind of organisms or molds or something that were bothering her. And I got the general idea that she needed support and encouragement. That was something that his father had done. And, of course, he was not there to do it anymore.
Yeah. Now, nowadays we just write so many emails, and I fear for historians of tomorrow in terms of their efforts. It's going to be difficult tracking all this stuff down because it's just kind of in the digital ether and in many ways gets lost. And so letter writing, even beyond the fact that we just write emails and we don't write letters per se, there's something lost in the fact that we don't do this anymore. And I wanted to ask you what about this very important form of media, letter writing, you know, what did this afford soldiers and their families as opposed to, you know, what we might do today with a quick telephone call or an email? What does a letter actually offer that other things don't?
I think a letter is more personal, especially when they're handwritten, as Machen's were. You can, through the handwriting, you can get a sense of the stress or the busyness of the person who's involved in writing the letter. Of course, you know, typewriters pretty much clean that up. Machen went to typing his letters when he was at home and used a typewriter consistently. So you lose that sort of personal aspect, I think, with a typewriter.
Oh, yeah.
And emails are now really typed letters that are not on paper. They're stored with little bytes on some kind of memory device somewhere. But I've thought about this a lot, and I think that if a person has a sense of what can be done with email, actually email may be better than letters. I know people will hate hearing that, special seminarians and historians. But you know, an email has a time and date. It always has the person's name on there. I don't know how many letters I've been frustrated with over the years, not in the case of Machen's letters in the book, but other writers who just forgot to date their letters, and I'm dying to know, when did he write this letter? Well, the email, you know when it was written.
Yeah.
And if a person is conscious that emails might be used in the future for historical purposes, I think it's a great opportunity. Yeah. Just has to remember to keep them on a memory device so people can access them for the future. I mean, you would actually have the ability, if there's any value in it, to reconstruct a person's day based on the time and date in the email. Might be kind of spooky, actually. But
well, it might already be happening without us knowing about it.
Uh-oh.
I know that you guys know, you know, some people's emails look like they typed them with their feet, and other people's emails are composed just like they would compose a letter, you know, and that's the way it should be. It's the tyranny of the urgent, you know. I got to get this answer to so-and-so, and so I just whip it out, and I don't worry about upper and lower case and punctuation, and my wife teaches middle school language arts, and students, you know, if I text in lowercase and don't punctuate, it doesn't matter. Why does it matter when I sit down and write a paper for Mrs. Waugh? You know, it's a matter of what you do with it. I think email has a potential to be a wonderful resource for historians, but if the person writing the email doesn't care, then maybe it's not such a good resource.
Yeah.
I mean, emails personal. You can write them to mom. You can write them to the kids. You can do whatever you want to with them, and make the most of them.
I just suppose it does come down to how they're stored and what access an historian might have to something.
Yeah.
At least with a letter, if somebody puts it in a file cabinet, that or just keeps it in, you know, a pile of papers, that could be discovered. But if it's on somebody's computer that eventually gets recycled or thrown out or erased, it seems a little more volatile, even oddly enough, than paper for historical purposes.
But well, some folk do of course print out their email. I'm one of those in between guys where if it's an important email, I'll print it out. But you're right, electronically you do well. Every man-made thing has the potential of being destroyed.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Whether it's electronic or whether it's paper.
Now, you mentioned Machen was conscious of the fact that these letters might be read down the road, and he was interested in keeping them organized. What type of system did he have, or what type of way did he encourage his mother to store his letters?
I'm not sure about the mother aspect, but I do know that Grace Mullen has kept Machen's letters as Machen stored them himself. Now, I believe that the files basically are chronological, and that it's sometimes, like if he happened to write a particular bunch of correspondence with someone, those might be in a dedicated file. So I believe there's about 30 linear feet of archival boxes at Westminster with Machen's letters and, of course, other things in there, Christmas cards and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And he stored them himself, so that there's one letter in the collection that had a lot of footnotes in the book, and that was because he had gone back when he got home and wrote out the geographical locations.
Oh, yeah.
Because he could not put those in the letter due to censorship, of course, you don't want the enemy to find out information about where you are and that kind of thing. And when he wrote those in, it was to help his family, you know where he was and so forth. But I think also it was for posterity. It was for me. Anybody that reads a book, that they are able to know where he was. And that's part of the reason I wanted the maps in there, is to give people a real sense of space and that he was really in particular locations and that sort of thing.
Indeed. Now, if he wrote forgive me if there's some obvious explanation to this, seeing that he wrote just on regular paper most of the time with a fountain pen, if he sent his mother a letter, did he just retrieve it later after she passed or later and put it in his own files? How did he get those letters back, if there weren't duplicates up front?
I guess it got him back either when he came back home or, as you mentioned, when she died. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. I think it's a question Grace would have to answer, because she would know how the collection at the seminary actually came together.
I know when the Van Til... That's interesting. I know in the Van Til archives, when Van Til was writing official letters, his secretary would just type on carbon paper, so there'd be an automatic duplicate that would get filed, where the original would be sent off to whomever it was sent off to. But in this case, just a handwritten letter. I've always been curious of where these come from. And that might actually shape, historically, our view of Machen, because the letters we're reading are the ones that are available to us. He, who knows whom he might have written letters to that never got returned to him or put back in his file. There could be stacks of them somewhere. Anyway, it's fascinating to talk about these interests and whatnot, but I think I want to turn a little bit, just in our remaining time, to maybe some intellectual influence or theological influence. You already mentioned part of the language and his desire to at least be able to speak a little bit, but did French culture in general have any influence on Machen, or was he fairly isolated from the French particulars, being on the front?
He was definitely interested in all things French. He really saturated himself until he received his first assignment at the YMCA hut in St. Marthe. He was studying the French language and reading French literature and attending plays performed by French speakers. He would actually take the French text of a play and read it before he went to see the play, And then he would go to the play and hope that his previous reading would help him to get through the dialogue
right.
that was taking place. He did comment that French poetry was just, it was just a mystery to him. He was having great difficulty with that. I mentioned he sought out a lady to eat with so he could converse
yeah.
with her. She was the widow of a pastor, yeah. Protestant pastor there in Paris. And he wanted to see her country through her eyes. And it's kind of interesting. I think that given Machen's interest in New Testament and grammatico-historical exegesis, I think that he really wanted to understand the language, history, and culture of the French in a way that he would want to understand the language, history, and culture of New Testament times. It's the saturation method, you know. You learn an awful lot. One thing I do is to the aggravation of my daughter and to the patience of my wonderful wife, I go around and I look up graves of Presbyterians of the past.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you can tell a lot from a grave. I know one person I studied, he left specific instructions in his will that he wanted a modest, small grave marker. And when I located his grave, it had this, I would say, about a 15-foot tall obelisk.
Wow.
With all this text on it and all this stuff that his family had decided to ignore his specific wishes because of, you know, he was a modest person, and honor him with this large grave marker. But, you know, the idea is, I think if you really study somebody, you want to know everything about them. I remember talking to Sean Lucas when he was studying Dabney. He had made great efforts to go to the different sites that Dabney had been associated with. He wanted to get a sense of what Dabney was talking about. I think it was when Dabney was standing on the campus of Davidson University. I believe at that point Dabney was almost totally blind. If I remember correctly, Sean went and stood on the campus of Davidson. The main campus has not changed over the years, the horseshoe area or the square or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think it's important. And Machen went to France. He says, hey, I'm going to be French. You
uh-huh.
know, I'm not only going to be a minister of the gospel, and I'm not only going to stew and brew hot chocolate, but, you know, I'm going to take advantage of this situation, and I'm going to enjoy the French, and I'm going to fuss about the Americans that, you know, don't want to get involved, and learn about the French. And, you know, he's a scholar. And he even studied New Testament French scholarship, and his general assessment was there wasn't much there, but he did study it.
Yeah.
So,
Barry, almost anybody that would go through that kind of experience of being in the near the front lines of a major war is going to be affected by that experience. With regard to Machen, are there any lasting effects upon him spiritually, experientially, and theologically that you're aware of?
Well, I think Stonehouse mentions that the war affected Machen. Darrell talks about it in his book, Defending the Faith. And there's no doubt that he was affected by the war. My perception is that even though he was a man in his mid-30s when he went to France, and you remember here, a lot of these guys that were going over from the States were guys out of high school, young people.
Right.
And typically young people will either have a sort of gung-ho, let's go get the glory type thing, or be absolutely terrified, or somewhere in between there. And I think to some degree, Machen had that, let's beat the Germans and their allies, and let's make it safe for the French people and the other people who were being oppressed by the Germans and others at the time. And I think I mentioned, you know, he had a privileged life. Maybe he was a little bit naive about what he was going to run into in the war. But he had his cage rattled just like everybody else did. when he saw what it was, you know, this isn't like reading Thucydides or whatever, and war is an awful thing. And I think when he responded that he was going to be a fighter for peace once the war was over, it showed that he had been shaken by the war. And I think also it made him more jealous for the gospel. At his closest time to the front, I believe he was less than 3 miles. His hut was less than 3 miles from the trenches. People were dying, you know, within the view of the curvature of the earth. And it made him all the more concerned for the supernatural gospel, for the gospel that saves people from sin and death. And guys were dying all around him, and I think he grew a lot through the war. I wrote an article about Machen's relationship with an alcoholic friend of his, Richard Hodges, and during that friendship, he went overseas in the war. And his attitude about Richard changed when he came back. Richard had sort of been a real friend, but sort of a spiritual project, sort of a diaconal project with Machen. That's my impression. I could be wrong. But he was, you know, somebody he was helping because he felt like he should do it. He had the means and the interest to do it. When he came back from the war, he was saying, you know, this is a guy that's been given to me by God's providence to help out. So yes, he changed. It affected him theologically in that he became more concerned for the gospel and the dying, and helped him, I think, through those hard years he was about to face as he got into the controversies at Princeton Seminary and within the Presbyterian Church. And maybe it sort of helped him sharpen his bayonet and clean his rifle as he was going to face some really tough times of spiritual conflict.
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating to hear about and to study and to get a window into the life, or a very important time in the life of one of American Presbyterianism's biggest figures. Jeff, we have any other follow-up or final questions before we say goodbye to Barry?
I was trying to think. No, I mean, there's so much that's of interest here.
Oh, of course.
Of what benefit, you know, what can we take away from the experience of Machen on the battlefront, front lines of a major war? And maybe this is covered in some of the letters, but there clearly was Richard Gamble, not the theologian Richard Gamble, but the historian Richard Gamble, has written a book on the World War I and America's entry into it, and the frankly, from my perspective, the what might have been the blurring of the distinction between America and the Church. Is there any sense in the letters, Barry, that Machen was concerned about that equation? In other words, the benefits to America are equated with if America does well, that means the Church is doing well. Is that a concern of his at all in the letters?
I didn't see anything about that at all, but that's the kind of thing I would think Machen would have found repugnant, and even if it was a common feeling among Americans of the time, I don't know that he would have talked about it unless he'd been directly confronted with it. I think of his hatred for the term religious work with respect to the YMCA. He wanted to get into the religious work and away from hot chocolate and selling cigarettes or whatever else, and be involved in helping the soldiers spiritually. But he hated religious work because, he doesn't say this, but I would assume because it takes the gospel and makes it just one religion among religions, when in fact it's not a religion. It is the gospel of God's grace. It's not a works religion. It is a total grace religion.
Right.
And I'm using the word religion, and I don't even like it. But
you know,
he was concerned for the uniqueness of the gospel, and you know, he was not a religious worker. He was a gospel worker. He was a gospel minister, a Presbyterian minister, and he was concerned for that. I think he had a good sense of the distinction between church and state. We can even go into the Southern factor here with the spirituality of the church.
Right.
And he would, even though I don't remember anything in the letters about what you're talking about, Jeff, he would not have thought too much of that type of a thinking.
Well, it would be like, you know, in the Civil, he reacted strongly, did he not, to the singing of the Battle Hymn of the Republic in church services?
Yeah, he didn't like
it. It would have been that writ large, America entering World War I, and I can imagine that Dr. Machen would have had a real hard time with that, and that would have been pushed into his face going over and serving in the YMCA.
You know, a lot of examples of Machen's views on the relationship of the church and the state, and he was opposed to the teaching of the Bible in public schools, for instance, things like that just indicate that he did think for himself, but he also was zealous for the gospel, but also in the context of a reformed ecclesiology.
Yeah.
But,
you know, things have changed a lot since 1918.
Oh, and then there, of course, was another war
after
Machen had passed, of course. But, my, what a significant influence this was, the Great War. They don't call it that for because it's just for on accident, but indeed it shaped many people. I appreciated Carl Truman's blurb on the back of this book. J. Gresham Machen is a fascinating, complex, and controversial figure. What is often forgotten is that he was also a member of the generation of young men whose lives were forever changed by their exposure to the horrors of trench warfare in the First World War. So we want to thank you for bringing this to us, Dr. Waugh. This book is a valuable resource for people interested in the life of Machen, but also people wanting to grasp, just get a handle on, you know, this time period. It's a very important effort that you've done, and I want to thank you for first for transcribing and editing this volume, but also secondly for coming on the program today to discuss it.
Well, I just wanted to say I'm grateful to the seminary and PNR for publishing the book. It was a long road, and I think the finished product is attractive and has 95% of the things in it that I wanted, and I don't think I'm unique with authors in that, you know, things aren't always 100%. But it's about as close to 100% as I think it could have gotten. And thank you all for interviewing me.
Oh, yeah.
And I enjoy talking about it because nobody has asked me about to talk about it before you guys. And I do have another opportunity in the future.
Great.
Which I'll be talking about the book again.
Great. Well,
absolutely.
I'm glad to introduce this volume to the listeners. And we want to mention everybody again, check this out. You can get it at WTSbooks.com. It's also available in other places. But Letters from the Front, J. Gresham Machen's Correspondence from World War I, a co-publication from Westminster Seminary Press and Presbyterian and Reformed Publishers. It's available now. You can get it for a reasonable price. Pick it up and read it today. I do want to point people back to the website. You can visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs. We also have a new reading list that we just published, and it's in process. So, you know, as we receive feedback and continue to discuss things with one another, we'll add some books, remove some others, maybe move some things around. But you can find that under the resources menu on our website, reformedforum.org/resources/reading list. And, of course, if you want to get a hold of us, you can tweet us at Reformed Forum or email us at mail@reformedforum.org. And if you want to be like Machen, you can write us a letter in a fountain pen Address it to P.O. Box 27422, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19118. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.